To be in, I'm not on, am I? I'm sorry. We're going to be in Jeremiah chapter 34. Jeremiah chapter 34. So I'm sorry to say we have now passed the positive section of the book of Jeremiah. Remember, we just relished in it, didn't we, for those four chapters. He couched it right there in the middle, and he was an encouragement for a little while, and then there's kind of two structures in the biblical books. Either they conclude with something that's the focus of the book, or they put it in the middle of the book. And there's kind of two different formats. Well, that's kind of what Jeremiah does. He puts the most important section of the book right in the middle, and everything else kind of cascades from it. And so we're kind of cascading away from it. In the beginning, in the middle of the book, He's been preaching about how Israel and Judah, they're going to go into captivity because of their sin, their spiritual adultery, their iniquity, and their unwillingness to admit to it. They've pushed off Jeremiah. They've tried to slander or kill or silence him or imprison him. And everybody's trying to not listen to the message, but it's becoming more and more inevitable that it's true. However, right in the middle of the book where we just passed, Jeremiah gives a very positive message. That in spite of all the desolation and all of the consequences that will come in Judah's life, there is hope. There's hope because he has something for them on the other side of this one trial of the captivity, and he also has hope for them in the future. They don't have a limited time frame. Their history will last forever because there will be a good king that will sit on the throne. That will be the Messiah. There will be singing in the streets again, and that will be when he makes all things new. And there is hope, so Jeremiah can invest in it, and he can preach it. And so just because there's consequences now doesn't mean that God can't make something of them better in the future. Well, people are beginning to swallow this a little bit more. However, we're getting to the end of the time frame, and we're getting to the very end of the captivity, and we're seeing here in this next little section the last days of the people of Judah here, the last days. So before we get into it, did everybody get a handout? Did everybody get a handout on the way in? If you didn't get a handout, let me know, and we want to make sure we got one. Our guys are in the back. If you didn't get one on the way in. Looks like everybody did. Very good. All right. Thank you, guys. Appreciate that. We're going to be in Jeremiah chapter 34. I gave you a brief outline, as I always do, of the section we're in, just so we know where we're going and what's going to happen. And what happens in these next few chapters is a lot of little self-contained messages or stories about some things that took place here at the end. And there's a justification for why all this bad stuff is happening. And it tells us why they've been thinking the way that they do. So in chapter 34, we're going to only do this chapter today because it's its own little unit. It's connected to the next one. There's a reason they put them back to back, but we're going to look at that next week when we get there. So I want us to read the beginning, not the whole chapter, but the beginning of the book of this chapter, the beginning of the verses, just so we know what happened and what he's going to be preaching about. So instead of me telling you and then reading it, I'll read it and then I'll tell you. All right, so let's look at verse number 1, and we're going to get down to his message. At the very beginning, it's very normal, something he's already said to them. So look at verse number 1 of Jeremiah 34. The word which came unto Jeremiah from the Lord, when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, all his army and all the kingdoms of the earth of his dominion, all the people, fought against Jerusalem and against all the cities thereof. So this is at the end where Babylon is really cranking down on them. And it's also during the reign of Zedekiah, which is the last king of Judah. Verse number 2. Thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, go and speak to Zedekiah, king of Judah, and tell him, thus saith the Lord, behold, I will give this city into the hand of the king of Babylon, and he shall burn it with fire. Thou shalt not escape out of his hand, but shalt surely be taken and delivered into his hand. And thine eyes shall behold the eyes of the king of Babylon, and he shall speak with thee mouth to mouth, and thou shalt go to Babylon. So we've seen this message before. At the very, very end, before the last captivity, he doesn't tell them that they're, hey, if he turns, he will live. We're past that point now. They will go into captivity, they will lose, they will go into Babylon. Babylon will take them. And so he tells them that again. However, he does give a slight twinge of a positive message here. Look at the next couple verses. Verse number 4. Yet, hear the word of the Lord, O Zedekiah, king of Judah. Thus saith the Lord of thee, thou shalt not die by the sword, but thou shalt die in peace. And with the burnings of thy fathers, the former kings which were before thee, so shall they burn odors for thee, and they will lament thee, saying, Ah, Lord, for I have pronounced the word, saith the Lord. Then Jeremiah the prophet spake all these words unto Zedekiah, king of Judah, in Jerusalem, when the king of Babylon's army fought against Jerusalem, and against all the cities of Judah that were left, against Lachish and against Azekah, for these defense cities remained of the cities of Judah. So he says it to him at the very end, when they're coming to the last couple cities, he tells them two things. Babylon's coming, they're going to take you to captivity, you're going to lose, you're not going to win. He says to Zedekiah, though, however, you personally will make it to the other side of this. You will see the king face to face, you're going to talk to him, but he's going to let you live. He's not going to kill you, and you'll die in peace, and they'll have a great funeral for you. Now, for a Jew, that was a big deal. To die in disgrace or to not be buried, we've seen that phrase show up several times in Jeremiah, and then they will not bury them. That was a bad thing for somebody to die and then not be buried. The guy who was king right before him, his brother, Jehoiakim, when he died, they didn't have burnings for him. They didn't have a fancy funeral, and they didn't put up the incense, and they didn't lament him. And so it was a horrible disgrace on his name to not have that. So for Zedekiah, he's saying, you're still going to see all these consequences, but it could be worse than it is. Now, here, all that's kind of old news for us. We've seen this several times. Remember, Jeremiah is not in chronological order. It's more in topical order. So some of the message show up again and again. We've seen that message before. That one's old for us. And that's okay. This is where the chapter specifically gives us something new. So look at verse number 8. This is the word that came unto Jeremiah from the Lord after that the king Zedekiah had made a covenant with all the people which were at Jerusalem to proclaim liberty unto them. Liberty how? That every man should let his manservant and every man his maidservant, being an Hebrew or a Hebrewess, go free, and none should serve himself of them. We've seen that phraseology before. It means to have a slave for yourself means that you will serve yourself from them. To wit, of a Jew, his brother. Now, verse 10, when all the princes and all the people which had entered into the covenant heard that everyone should let his manservant and everyone his maidservant go free, that none should serve themselves of them anymore, then they obeyed and let them go. Now, in just a moment, I'm going to read this verse in this exact chapter. I'll read it here in a second. But he references this law. In the law of Moses, you were not allowed to keep a slave indefinitely. Also, in the law of Moses, it shows why you kept a slave. When we see slavery in the Bible, we just copy and paste the 1860s in the American South into the Hebrew lifestyle. And it was not the same. It was not the same. By the way, first of all, slavery existed in like every civilization since the beginning of time up until the last couple hundred years. How it manifested itself was different from society to society. Most of the time, if somebody had a slave, they were considered not a slave owned by you, but they were considered a indebted servant. They owed you something, and so then you worked for them on their property. Now, some people chose to live with you for the rest of their life. You were a good master. You took care of them and their family. You gave them a place to live. You gave them things to eat. They worked hard on your farm, and they had all their needs met, so they said, this is great. We'll stay, and they became family. So it couldn't have been that bad if some people chose it for the rest of their life. However, in the law of Moses, God recognizes how easy it is for men to oppress other people, and history has borne that out. And so there was a provision that said every 7 years, debts were forgiven, and then slaves had nothing else to pay. This was especially true in a major reset every seven years, which would be the 50th year. After 49, then the following year would be a huge forgiveness of all that. So that's what they were supposed to do. You were not supposed to keep a servant indefinitely unless they wanted to stay with you. And they had a good thing going, let's just keep this going. Otherwise, you would forgive them, they had nothing to owe you, and they would go free. Well, the children of Israel are not notorious for obeying the law of Moses, that's for sure, especially not during the time of Jeremiah. I mean, we even hear in some of these later kings, like Hezekiah and Josiah, that they've kept the Passover for the first time in centuries. And so a lot of things they weren't doing. And so for something as unselfish as forgiving debts that people still owe you, certainly wasn't something that they were doing. However, here we are, months before Jerusalem's going to completely fall apart. And we have a brief statement that Zedekiah, a not good king, gets all the people together and they collectively agree to forgive debts and let their servants go. Now, I want to read you a couple passages from the law that this is what God wanted them to do. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 15. I gave it to you in your handout. Verse number 11 of Deuteronomy 15. He says, the poor shall never cease out of the land, meaning he's going to preface what he's going to say. You're always going to have poor people around you. So obviously we need these provisions because you're always going to need them. Poor shall never cease out of the land. Therefore, I command thee, saying, thou shalt open thine hand wide unto thy brother, to thy poor and to thy needy in thy land. And if thy brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, be sold unto thee and serve thee 6 years, in the seventh year, thou shalt let him go free from thee. When thou sendest him out free from thee, thou shalt not let him go away empty. Thou shalt furnish him liberally out of thy flock and out of thy floor and out of thy winepress. Of that wherewith the Lord thy God hath blessed thee, thou shalt give unto him. This is an unprecedented thing in the ancient world. Slaves were considered property, less than human. And so in the law of Moses for him to say, they are not your property. They're going to work for you until their debt is paid, or until this time frame ends, you're going to let them go. And you don't just let them go, you pay them on the way out the door. Help them to start their new life. Give them some of your wine, give them some of your food, give them some of your money, give them some of your flock, help their life get started. Why? Because you would want that somebody to do that for you, so you do that for them. The same is true of every 50 years, Leviticus 25. If thy brother that dwelleth by thee be waxen poor and be sold unto thee, thou shalt not compel him to serve as a bondservant, but as a hired servant and as a sojourner. He shall be with thee and shall serve thee unto the year of Jubilee, which was the 50th year. And then shall he depart from thee, both he and his children with him, and shall return unto his own family, unto the possession of his fathers shall he return. And for they are my servants, which I brought forth out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as bondmen. Thou shalt not rule over him with rigor, but shall fear thy God. He said, be kind, be gentle to them. Don't be harsh with them. All of you were servants, and I set you all free. So if your brother needs to pay a debt, don't treat him as a slave. They're not slaves anymore. These are free people. Treat him kindly. Don't treat him harshly. And then fear the Lord, and that will dictate the way that you work with people. This is how they were supposed to do things. It's not how they usually did things. But here we have a very random passage of a very wicked people living in debauchery and idolatry and in wickedness and lasciviousness. And before they're about to fall apart, they all let their slaves go. Now, you guys are still in Jeremiah 34? Look at verse 11. So good. Badge of honor. You get a gold star, Judah. You did the right thing for once. Verse 11. But afterward, they turned and caused the servants and the handmaids whom they had let go free to return and brought them into subjection for servants and for handmaids. So you know all those people they just let go? All those men and all those women servants that they just set free? Later, they all gathered them back up and brought them back to the farm, and now they're servants again. Now, what's the whiplash about? It's difficult to say. I gave you the passage. I'm not going to read it, but I gave it to you. Remember, Jeremiah is not in chronological order, so sometimes different notes kind of help us understand some things. In Jeremiah chapter 37, a couple chapters later, so we're going to preach about it in like 3 weeks, and we'll get there. There's a brief note that while Babylon was besieging Israel, there was a small amount of time where they left because they were forced out. Pharaoh of Egypt doesn't like Babylon either. And so he comes up, he hears Babylon's in town, and their presence forces Babylon to retreat briefly. Now, Jeremiah, in chapter 37, preaches a message and says, guys, the Babylonians are going to come back. This isn't going to last forever. And almost every commentator I read mentioned that the reason why they let their slaves go free and then the reason why they brought them back in was because they were afraid of the imminent danger of Babylon taking them over. And then suddenly they felt better because now Babylon is gone. And as I read through all of that, it made me think about how often that's what we do as Christians. We know what we're supposed to do. We do. We just don't like to do it because we're selfish people and we're sinful people and we're fleshly people. But then when there's pressure, then suddenly we get a lot of things right because we realize there's problems and we need to fix some things. And oh no, what's going to happen unless I turn around? And so then we end up in church again, and then we end up down at the altar again, and then we end up making things right with our family again. And then things get better, and we breathe a breath of fresh air. Things are loosening up. Things aren't as bad as they used to be, and then we end up back where we were before because we don't need to do them anymore. This is exactly what we see in their life. All of a sudden, they realize, oh, Jeremiah is right. We're actually going to lose our nation. And so they start flipping through the law of Moses. What are some things we're not doing? We need to let our slaves go free because we haven't been doing that for a while. It's the seventh year. Let them all go free. Then Babylon moves out of town. Egypt was there. They're scared. They leave. We're fine. And then they go and gather them all back up and go right back to where they were before. We need to do right for the right reasons. We need to do right for the right reasons. So, picture a man and a woman. They're talking. The man says to her, honey, I will be faithful to you. I will be there for you in sickness and in health. I will be there whether we have a lot or a little. I'll be there for the good times and the bad times. I will do whatever we need to make this family work. Okay? They're having this conversation. Now, behind the man and the woman, put an arch with flowers. Put a pastor underneath of it. Put an altar in the front. And fill a room with a lot of people watching. A lot of guys on one side, a lot of girls on the other side. The guys are wearing suits. The girls are wearing dresses. What are we at? We're at a wedding. Okay. So all those words mean something because they're well-intentioned. Now, take the same man and woman. Honey, I will be faithful to you. I will be there for you whether you are sick, whether we have a lot of money, in the good times and the bad times. I will do whatever we need to make this family work. But delete the arch and delete the suits and the dresses. Delete the room filled with people and the pastor and the altar. And instead, replace it with a couch and a bunch of crying children on the side of the room, and a wife whose mascara is running, and a cell phone with incriminating messages that he's been sending to another woman. Same vow, same promises, but completely different reason why they're being given. The setting is therefore completely different. Most of us, we label ourselves as spiritual when we make all the right vows to God to do what is right. But the reason we make them is because our lives are falling apart, not because we love God. Not because we beforehand have said, God, I'm going to serve you with my life and give you my whole life. We only make that vow when our life is sinking and we are afraid that we're going to lose everything. That's when the vows come out. Now, is it good to do that? Yes, but God's primary motivation that he gives to us for why we do the law, why we keep his commandments, the primary motivation is supposed to be love. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, I gave it to you, is the Shema. That's something that the Jewish children were supposed to quote every day of their life. If I were to summarize the entire law of Moses into one unit, it would be the Shema. And I think I'm justified in doing that because when Jesus was asked the question, summarize the entire law of Moses into one command, he quoted the Shema. He says, well, what is the whole law of Moses? Is it whether or not you're clean and what you eat, or you're clean and what you wear, you're clean and what you touch, or where you go and when you don't, or how you do the rituals and the sacrifices and the tabernacle, whether you give enough peace offerings, whether you give enough burnt offerings, whether you give enough meal offerings, whether you tithe right, whether you tithe every third year to the poor, whether you were faithful in releasing your slaves or not. And Jesus responds and he says, love the Lord with all your heart. That is the point of the law. That's why it's in Deuteronomy, because they didn't get that. So when he gave the law again, he says, the point of all these laws is a relationship with me. All of the obedience that I want from you is supposed to stem from a love for me. But a lot of times we get it backwards. And our motivation for obeying God is not that we love him, it's that we love us. And we're afraid of what's going to happen. And so we start obeying God when we're worried that he's not going to take care of us. We start treating God like the ancient people treated pagan gods. Well, I'm going to do these things for Baal so that I have a good crop. And then when it's not raining, I'm going to do more things for Baal because I'm worried that Baal's mad at me. And then when it rains again, then I can lighten up. And that's how we treat God. And that's not what he wants. So I'm going to give you a couple points very quickly this morning. That's the whole message. And there's four truths that we can learn from this. So number one, before I give you too much more, I want to give you this. Number one, it is always a good time to do the right thing. It is always a good time to do the right thing. By the way, our fellows are coming by. If you could do me a favor and just put your attendance slip in, just so we know who all's here. In Sunday school, we'd appreciate that. Okay, so I made it sound like these people are doing the wrong thing because I painted them in a very negative light. And there's a certain level of truth to the negativity of the light that I've painted them in. However, let's look at how God sees this. I read verse 11, but when God reiterates what happened, he like repeats it back to them. I want us to read what he says. So look at verse number 12. Look at verse 12. Therefore, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, I made a covenant with your fathers in the day that I brought them forth out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondmen, saying, at the end of 7 years, let ye go every man his brother in Hebrew, which has been sold unto thee. And when he served thee 6 years, thou shalt let him go free from thee on the seventh. But your fathers hearkened not unto me, neither inclined their ear. And ye were now turned and had done right in my sight in proclaiming liberty every man to his neighbor. And ye had made a covenant before me in the house which is called by my name. So here, he doesn't rebuke them. He knows the reason why they did it. He knows that they're going to go back on their covenant very soon. But when he repeats what happened, what does he say they did? He says, you did the right thing. Now, should they have done the right thing before? Yes, they didn't, and now it's today. But they did the right thing today. Should they have done it because their lives were falling apart or because of their love for the Lord? They should have done it out of their love for the Lord. And God knew that as well. They should have done it earlier. They should have done it more often. But it's not those days. It's today. And they did the right thing. And so God commended that. It is always a good time to do the right thing. A lot of times we put ourselves in bad situations because a lot of previous bad decisions that we made. And the mindset that Satan can get us into is there's no way forward. There's no good way to respond today anymore. Every version of my response is going to be bad because I put myself in a bad situation. But that's not true. We were reading through the law in Bible class, and we came across Deuteronomy chapter 17. Deuteronomy chapter 17, the second half of the chapter, is an odd passage, because it describes exactly how Israel is supposed to react in a situation that they should never be in. He says at the beginning of the passage, you should not get a king. I should be your king. You should not look out into the rest of the nations and say, well, they have a king and they have a strong leader. We want one of those. Don't do that. But you're gonna. And when you do, this is what your king should look like. What an odd law. He prefaces, this law shouldn't exist, but it will, and you're going to need it. And so when you do that, this is how you move forward. So fast forward to 1 Samuel chapter 8, I think. It's roughly around there. Beginning of the book of 1 Samuel. Samuel's the last judge. His sons aren't really that great. They're looking around, they say, we don't want your sons to judge us. Actually, you know what we want? We want a king, like the rest of the nations. And Samuel warns them, and he says, don't be like the rest of the nations. Serve the Lord. He is your king. He says, God, I don't know what to do. And God tells Samuel, it's okay. They didn't reject you as their judge. They rejected me as their king. And so they chose to have a man as their king, and they shouldn't have. But there's a way forward. The first thing that God does is he communicates with Saul that he will fill him with his spirit in order to do this work that he can't do on his own. And he does. He gives him several miraculous signs to show Saul that he will be with him if Saul obeys. And it's a strange order of events. They're doing things they shouldn't do, and now they have crossed this threshold that now they have a king, and then God says, wow, you shouldn't be here, but this is how we move forward. There is always a right way to go and a wrong way to go today. Even if the fork in the road that you're in today is one you shouldn't be at. They shouldn't have been there. They shouldn't have been deciding whether or not how the king is going to react, because they shouldn't have had a king. But they did. And so today, there's a right way to respond. So today, your king needs to make a copy of the word of God. Today, your king needs to know not to go down to Egypt for horses and to trust in them and to not multiply wives to himself. Shouldn't have a king, but this is how he should be. The people of Israel shouldn't have been in the tight corner that they were. Babylon shouldn't have been at their gates about to take over the city, but they were. But that doesn't mean it's a bad time to obey what God has told us to do. And so when they released their slaves, probably for the first time in a long time, God said, good, that was the right thing to do. So don't allow Satan to discourage you into a corner and tell you that it doesn't matter whether or not you do the right thing today. It is always a good time to obey God's will for your life. No matter what situation that you're in, don't throw in the towel and say that you're done just because you made a mistake. There is always a path forward, and there can be a right way forward as opposed to a wrong way forward today. So, preface it with that. God's not upset with them that they freed their slaves. He told them to, so they did, so that was a good thing. Number two, making sincere vows as a last resort will most likely not undo God's plan. Sometimes what we want to do is impress God with our righteousness enough so that he's going to go, okay, just kidding. Everything I told you, I'm not going to do that anymore. So this whole chapter we've been reading, and he prefaces everything before he says, you released your slaves. That was a good thing. Before he says any of that, he reiterates what he has been preaching. We're at the point now. You're gonna go into captivity. It's gonna happen. He doesn't go back on any of it. He's been telling them, he's been warning them of that. And that's still there. And whether their motivation was to try to get God to take that back, I don't know, but it didn't. Now, the reason I said sincere vow, though, is because I want to ask the question, how serious were they about this? Was it just a haphazard, like, hey, they had a morning meeting, what do you think we should do? Let's release our slaves, sure, whatever. And it really, they really didn't mean it. Because the whole context makes it seem like they didn't mean it. They released them one day, they got them back the next. It seems like they weren't serious about it at all, except for the way the Bible describes the decision that they made. He's already said, you've made a covenant with me in my house. But what does that mean? Well, he gives us some indications here a couple verses later. So once you skip down to verse 18 and 19, and all my Bible scholars out there, I want you to see if you know what he's talking about. Verse 18 and 19. I will give the men that have transgressed my covenant, remember, because he's told them they've gone back on it, so that's what he's talking about now. They've transgressed my covenant, which have not performed the words of the covenant, which they had made before me, watch, when they cut the calf in twain and passed between the parts thereof. Verse 19, the princes of Judah and the princes of Jerusalem, the eunuchs and the priests and all the people of the land, which passed between the parts of the calf. Does anybody know what we're talking about? Pastor does. Okay, this would remind you of a story a long time ago, an odd story. all the way back in Genesis chapter 15. This is a different story, a different covenant, different deal. God's making a covenant with Abraham, and he's solidifying his promise that he's going to multiply his seed, and he's going to do all the blessing of Abraham with the land and multiplying the seed and make through him the blessing to the rest of this world. So a promise, watch, a promise is being made. And he tells Abraham to do something. He tells him to take several animals, kill them, and cut them in half. And then place them next to each other with a space in between. So a couple animals, a couple birds, and so now you have this pathway of dead animals. Now, in that culture, if you made a very sincere covenant with somebody else, you would make a sacrifice path like that, and then you would walk through the path together with the other person you're making the covenant with in order to solidify it that you really mean this. And there was a sense in which what you were saying was, if I am not faithful to my end of the deal, then let this happen to me, that I will be giving my life, you know, cross my heart and hope to die, stick a needle in my eye, whatever. So that's the idea of this. Now, side thing, as a cool part of the story is after Abraham makes this path, he falls asleep, and he wakes up to seeing God's presence going through the path alone. The covenant was unconditional. Okay, put Abraham aside. According to Jeremiah chapter 34, the only deal that they made in this book, in this chapter, was that they were going to free all their slaves. And here he's describing the fact that they have gone back on the deal of this covenant that they have made. But he doesn't just say they chose to do it. He says they walked in between the calf that had been cut in twain and passed between it. All the people, remember a minute ago, all the people agreed. All the people agreed to free the slaves. And now all the people, princes, eunuchs, priests, the people of the land, they passed between the parts of the calf as well. What they were saying is, God, we really mean it. We're going to obey your law now. We're going to do what you've asked us to do, and we're going to make it a public, a showy. We're going to come down. We're going to fill out the decision card. We're going to tell everybody that we really, really mean it. And maybe they really, really did when everything was going really bad. And they did one of the most solemn things that they could do in their culture to show God how much they really meant this vow. But we know that they didn't really mean it because they didn't even keep it. Making a sincere vow as a last resort is probably not going to change God's plans. If God has already been saying, hey, this is what's going to happen, we're not going to undo everything that's gone on. Let's go back to the guy who's been cheating on his wife in the room with the couch and the crying kids. He is just begging his wife to forgive him, and he's profusely making promises to do the dishes every night and take her out on a date every week and to finally take her to Europe like he always promises, and he's never going to lie again, right? We can picture this, and he means it. Is he being insincere? Probably not. Probably not. He probably really, truly means everything he's saying. But watch. It doesn't just make the fact that he cheated on his wife just go away. It doesn't just not happen anymore. Consequences and problems still come into our life when we make bad decisions. And a lot of us, our motive is wrong because our motive is to get God to just be like, oh, okay. And our expectation that all the bad decisions and the sins that we have committed in the past are just going to, oh, okay. And it doesn't work that way. Now, God can have grace. God can have mercy. God can allow us to have a different future because of that. Absolutely. But that doesn't just mean all of this, oh, just kidding, it never happened. Because it doesn't work that way. Remember way back earlier in the book of Jeremiah, he describes the decisions that they made as being written with a pen of iron and the point of a diamond? Remember that? Everything we've ever done, we will always have done them. Everything we have ever said, we will always have said them. And no matter how we move forward, what we do matters. And so here they are making these very solemn vows to God. And then when things lightened, they went back on them anyway. This whole passage is framed around the fact that this is where they're going, and this is the right thing to do. But don't try to manipulate God into changing the consequences of our own decisions. Okay, number three. Having talked about that, number three, never go back on your vows or obedience to God, especially not because the consequences have lightened. Don't go back on your vows or obedience to God, especially not because consequences have lightened. Look back to verse number 16. It talks about how they made these vows. They did what they were promising to do. But he says this, after he describes the whole thing, you let him go. You did right. Verse 16, but you turned and polluted my name and caused every man his servant, every man his handmaid, whom he had set at liberty at their pleasure, to return and brought them into subjection to be unto you for servants and for handmaids. You turned and polluted my name, he says. You made a good promise. You did what was right, and now you turn back on it. Go down to verse number 20. He says this, I will even give them into the hand of their enemies and into the hand of them that seek their life. Their dead bodies shall be as meat for the fowls of heaven and to the beasts of the earth. Zedekiah, king of Judah, and his princes will I give into the hand of their enemies and into the hand of them that seek their life and into the hand of the king of Babylon's army, which are gone up from you. Behold, I will command, saith the Lord, and cause them to return to the city. They shall fight against it, take it, burn it with fire, and will make the cities of Judah a desolation without inhabitant. And so he reminds them about the consequences. The reason he brings up, and in context, them walking between the calf. Remember, the whole covenant, and this is a sad thing, the whole idea of the picture of the covenant is, if I break my covenant, then let this happen to me. Right? Well, they broke their covenant. And they basically signed their own fate. It was like, we're not making our future any better. Because now they said, it really makes a difference. And he says, so you made a very solemn vow and you didn't even keep it. And now you're still expecting everything to go well in the future. Let me read you a passage in Ecclesiastes chapter 5. He talks about the decisions that we try to make. And he says this in verse number 1, keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they consider not that they do evil. Be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God. For God is in heaven, and thou upon earth, therefore let thy words be few. Verse 3, for a dream, or goals, or ideas, or possibilities that we imagine, cometh through the multitude of business. We accomplish things in our life. We move forward in our walk by actually being diligent, not by talking a lot about it. Second half, and a fool's voice is known by a multitude of words. He says this, when thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. Better is it that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay. Suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin, neither say thou before the angel. Oh, it was an error. Just kidding. That's literally what that means. Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thine hands? In a multitude of dreams and many words, there is also diverse vanities, but fear thou God. I preached an entire 40-minute message on the 7 verses we just read, so I'm not going to redo that. There's a lot in this passage. He says we need to listen before we make vows to God or else we're going to be desperately trying to maybe do the wrong thing. We're actually not aiming for the right goal because we haven't listened to what God's actually telling us to do. So we're just doing whatever we think we're supposed to do, and then we start plowing after that. He says listen first. He says don't just make vows. Obey God. Spirituality is not embedded in the abundance of decisions we make. It's embedded in the abundance of steps that we take that are in the right direction. Continuing making vows to God without keeping any of them is not what the Christian life is made out of. He says the best spiritual goal to have is to fear God. He says there's a lot of goals we can have, a lot of ideas that we can have, and a lot of ways to get there. He says there's diverse vanities in the multitudes of dreams. So what do we do? Fear God. That's the conclusion of the whole matter in Ecclesiastes chapter 12. fear God and keep his commandments. And it says this, God judges unmet promises. And this is what we often do. Our life is falling apart, our family's falling apart, our marriage is falling apart. And so we come to church, we go to the altar, we make decisions, and then things go better, and then we're gone. And he says, that is not how the Christian life is supposed to work. And God might be pleased with the decision you made today, but if it just goes away tomorrow, it doesn't really mean a whole lot. And just because we made it public and we made it sincerely and we tried to be very flamboyant in the way we made the decision, like the people walking through the path, doesn't mean it's any more solidified if we don't choose to be diligent in actually adding it to our life. Never go back on your vows or obedience to God, especially not because consequences have lightened up. I'll give you the last point and we'll be dismissed. Number four, freeing yourself from God's commands is to free yourself from God's help. Now, the reason I use that terminology is because I didn't know what to do with this verse when I read through it. Look at verse 17. It's an odd way he turns this phrase. In the middle of this whole thing, we know the whole context of the chapter now. We know exactly what happened. We know how God feels about it. Look at verse 17. Therefore, thus saith the Lord, ye have not hearkened unto me in proclaiming liberty, every one to his brother, and every man to his neighbor. Behold, I proclaim a liberty for you, saith the Lord, to the sword, to the pestilence, and to the famine, and I will make you to be removed into all the kingdoms of the earth. They were supposed to give liberty to their brother, and they did not. They did for a little bit, and they took it back. And now they wanted to be free themselves from what God was telling them to do. And so he says, I will give you liberty from my help. So when we don't have God's help, what would they have? Well, they would have pestilence and famine and sword loss. To which we're all saying, well, that's not freedom. Exactly. Freedom from God's law is freedom from God's presence. And freedom from God's presence is not freedom at all. And so he says, I will give you liberty to have famine and sword and pestilence. You are free to go down that path. You are. You are free from me. You're free from my laws. You're free from obeying me. If you don't want to give liberty to other people, you're free to do that. But you're also free from the help that I can give into your life. And that isn't really freedom. And that's not where we should live. And this, as I read through this, I thought, wow, what a typical picture of the average Christian. Obedience to God only becomes a priority when we feel like we need to make God happy with us again. And then as soon as things get better, and for them, it didn't even get that much better. It just lightened up a little today. The Babylonians weren't right outside their gates. They still lost most of their cities. The other, 2/3 of their people were still in captivity. There was still a lot of problems. They still had no leadership. They still had no craftsmen. They still had no warriors. They still had no princes. They still had a lot of problems, but it got a little bit lighter today, and they went, oh, we can go back to doing whatever we want. And that is way too typical of how we live, and it doesn't make our lives any better. And when we want freedom from God's oppression of his laws, we're freeing ourselves from all the help that God wants to give us. And that's not where God wants us to live. So that's the example in chapter 34. We're going to see something where it's on the other side of it in chapter 35. So come back next week and we will see that.